This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. What does the health of a native Virginia fish have to do with you? Well, if fishing is an activity you enjoy, that alone could be reason enough to want to see the Commonwealth's cold water brook trout protected. But it turns out conditions that harm this particular fish, and ones that help it thrive, can tell us a lot about what's going on in our own environment. So if clean water and healthy air are important to you, the latest update to a 25-year study is going to be worth noting. Short version, there is good news in this new report, but since it is more complicated than that, the scientists behind this research, and some who've been helping him, are here to flesh out the details. Got some opinions of your own about what kind of trade-offs are worth considering when it comes to protecting the natural world? Your perspective will be welcome, too, when our conversation begins right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. The new study is called the Virginia Trout Stream Sensitivity Study. It is the third such report that has been prepared in Virginia over the past quarter century. And this latest is the first to show some significant environmental improvement. The coordinator of the latest study is with us, University of Virginia environmental scientist Rick Webb. Mr. Webb, thank you for making time for us.
Thank you.
Also here from the U.S. Forest Service, forest fisheries biologist Dawn Kirk, and from the Virginia Department of Inland Game and Fisheries, fisheries biologist Paul Bugis. Welcome also to the two of you.
Hi, Tom.
Thank you.
And to you who are listening, if there is anything about clean air and clean water that is important to you, you are certainly invited to join our conversation this hour, either by calling us at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825, or by posting to us on Facebook, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. But right off, if you would, Rick Webb, give us a synopsis of these new findings. What did you find, and what was the good news, and if there was any, what was the not-so-good news?
Well, these findings, which you characterize as new, are relatively new. We've been studying these streams for about 30 years. We've been focused on the chemistry. We're looking at the chemistry of the brook trout streams, which drain our forested mountain watersheds. These are the streams that are susceptible to the effects of acid rain, which has been a problem throughout the eastern United States, and it was known beginning back in the 1970s. We initiated our program late in the 1970s with a focus on streams in Shenandoah National Park. And after studying these streams for a while, we expanded the program to most of the brook trout streams in western Virginia. Most of these streams are on public land, national forest, national park, Virginia Wildlife Management Area land, and some private land. Our program is focused on the water chemistry. We collect water samples on a periodic basis. On some streams, we collect water samples on a weekly basis. We collect on a seasonal or quarterly basis from others. And periodically, about every 10 years, we do these regional surveys where we collect water samples from about close to 400 streams. We recruit volunteers for that effort. We've involved about 200 people, mainly from Trout Unlimited, each time we've done this. In 1987, we did our first regional survey. We found that close to 50% of the streams were impaired by acidic deposition or acid rain. We selected a subset of those streams, which we sampled quarterly, about 65. And we've been tracking the changes over time. When we look at the differences between the three surveys, we see that some of the streams are beginning to show improvement. This we attribute to the benefits associated with the Clean Air Act, which was modified in 1990 to address the acid rain problem. The Clean Air Act regulates the emissions of sulfur primarily from power plants, and we've seen sulfuric acid, which is the acid formed from sulfur, being deposited in rain and in precipitation, decline over this period, and we're beginning to see a decrease in sulfur concentrations in our streams. And at the same time, we're seeing a decrease in the acidity, and it's generally good news. And I take it as as a measure of the value of our national investment in air pollution control. But our focus is mainly on water chemistry. Water chemistry sort of sets the environmental conditions for the brook trout and the other aquatic life that live in these streams, which require clean water. Our colleagues in the Natural Resource Agencies include Paul Bugis and Don Kirk that are here today, who are focused mainly on changes in aquatic life, fish, and other species.
One thing to note is that not all streams do acidify or acidify equally. You know, the streams that we're talking about here that Rick has been monitoring are your headwater, high elevation streams in the mountains of western Virginia.
And is it appropriate to say that what we're looking at here are sometimes called cold water streams?
It is. It is. And that would be cold water streams because we were interested in brook trout.
Right. This is Paul. Although the brook trout is the primary target for a lot of these cold water streams in terms of watching their performance over time. And they are sensitive. They require probably the most critical parameter that we measure besides nitrate, sulfate, and so forth is just simply stream temperature. They cannot live in environments that exceed 71 degrees Fahrenheit through the course of the summer. Otherwise, you see a totally different composition of fish species and move into the area. So brook trout need to have it cold. They need to have it clean, high oxygen, and usually found in very remote hills and hollows of western Virginia. But I might want to also add that DGIF and the Forest Service also have a long-term data set, too, and which sort of complements some of the work Rick and UVA have been doing, too, with their chemistry. We've been looking at the fisheries component and the macroinvertebrates, the bugs, if you will, that crawl all over the bottom part of the food web that exist in these streams. So we have a long data set, too, that helps us monitor and answer questions about this very important resource.
So overall, Paul Bugis, when it comes to the health of the environment, whether you're looking at the cold water native brook trout that exists primarily in western Virginia, or any of the other creatures and critters, insects or otherwise, what are you finding in terms of the degree to which things are thriving that you would expect to thrive if the environment is improving in its health? And to what degree are you finding that things are not really thriving as an indicator that things in the environment are not going so well?
Well, I think it depends on where you look. If you're looking at the brook trout component high in the mountains, some of the primary stressors would be acidic precipitation, climate change, invasive insects, and so on and so forth, changes in the forest ecology overall. When you look at the aquatic component in rivers and streams, once it leaves the forest and gets down into the valleys and so forth where the human population has expanded, you see different sorts of stressors with development and all kinds of things. You know, it's hard just to say everything out there is rosy and improving or everything out there is, you know, in bad shape. I think it depends on the watershed you're looking at and all the things that are going on in the landscape of the watershed. So some are getting better and some we need to work on a little bit more.
So one interesting thing when getting back to what Rick was saying as far as acid deposition, when I start talking to people about acid rain and acid deposition and the impacts that it's having here on the streams in Virginia, a lot of people don't even realize that it's still going on. They think, oh, I think we took care of that back in the 70s. And what's interesting is talking to them about the historical perspective. And when you look at the Northeast and the Adirondacks, where it acidified very quickly the streams and the lakes and the rivers up there. That area was glaciated, so they don't have the deep soils that we have here in Virginia because we were not glaciated. And we have deep, rich soils in the watershed, and so it took, we had a lot more buffering capacity within the watershed, and they're like sponges where they soak up the acid that the rain is putting in before we saw the impacts in the river.
This is Rick. Dawn makes a good point, and earlier she mentioned that there's a lot of variation in the response, and that variation is related to differences in the bedrock and the soil in the watersheds. Some streams were never impacted by acid rain, and some were damaged severely. The pH declined, the sulfur concentrations increased, and at the same time, the fish populations and the insect populations also declined. As things have improved in terms of acid deposition, some streams are recovering faster than others, and this again is related to their initial buffering capacity and the extent to which they've been damaged over this period of time that we've experienced this elevated level of acid deposition. And since 1990, the emissions of sulfur into the atmosphere from coal-fired power plants has decreased by about two-thirds. Now, that's remarkable, but the sulfur deposited from the atmosphere to our mountain watersheds is still several times greater than it would have been in background levels. So although we're seeing some recovery now, not all of the streams are recovering. The ones that are the most sensitive are not recovering. And some of the studies we've done, some of the models we've created, suggest that some of the streams are not going to recover in our lifetime, and we won't expect to see these streams naturally recover on their own.
And Rick Webb from the University of Virginia, it was just recently that UVA's press office issued a statement about your newest findings, and that, in fact, is what caught our attention and how we ended up doing this program today. But I want to read one line from that press release for you. It says here that you found that 77% of the sampled streams in the most recent study were suitable for brook trout reproduction. The 1987 and 2000 surveys showed that only 55% and 56% respectively were back then suitable for brook trout reproduction. I don't want to oversimplify, and we just heard Paul Bugis say that you can't say everything is rosy or everything is improving without looking at some other areas where things are not going so well. But it seems to me that that degree of jump over the past 22, 23 years in improvement in conditions for brook trout from 54 or 55% all the way up to 77% of the streams you looked at looking good, that's a sizable jump. Isn't that a good indication that something is going well?
I think so, yes. It's certainly good news. We have to take that, we have to be a little bit careful about that. We're only talking about 2 or 3 points in time. The results are not quite as encouraging when you look at the more detailed data, but it's clear that there has been improvement, and it's gratifying, and it's because of the Clean Air Act.
So, to you who are listening, what kind of trade-offs are you willing to consider when it comes to protecting the natural world? You may have noticed some heated debates going on in Washington very recently over just this question. Some say in the midst of a deeply troubled economy, it is more important to focus on allowing certain industries to create jobs rather than hamstringing them with environmental concerns. Others say we must care for the environment first at all costs. Got an opinion of your own to share? By phone, you can reach us at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. On Facebook, find us listed as Virginia Insight. We're already getting some posts on our Facebook page, and we'll get to those when we get back from the break. But let me say, as always, it is much more interesting to hear your voice rather than just hear the host reading all the Facebook posts. So if you're brave and you're willing to join us, 888-WMRA-TALK, we'll hope to talk to you when we get back. Don Kirk is a fisheries biologist from the U.S. Forest Service. Paul Bugis is a fisheries biologist from the State of Virginia's Department of Inland Game and Fisheries. Rick Webb is a senior scientist and project coordinator in the University of Virginia's Department of Environmental Sciences. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham. This is Virginia Insight. And we posted, Rick, a link to a copy of your latest findings on our Facebook page over the weekend so that anybody who wanted to do homework ahead of today's show could go read the study. And at least one person apparently did, because Robert here posted on that part of our Facebook page a reaction to having read your study. And he says, it's good to see improvement. While we debate the causes of global warming, most of the legislation that's held up could be adopted just for its beneficial effects on the environment. Any response?
Well, we're addressing a different problem with our study, which is related to power plant emissions primarily. But I agree. Yes, there is a lot of bad news about the environment, and this is one piece of good news. These brook trout streams mean a lot to a lot of people. They're sort of the best of what remains of the natural world, and I think it's a good thing that they look like they might get better in the future.
This is Paul. One of the interesting tools that we have been applying to some of these brook trout streams over time, that in areas where it's allowed, we've actually been applying limestone sand to some of our more acidified streams. And this basically sweetens the water up for a period of up to about 5 or 6 years before it needs to be applied again. This isn't new technology. Certainly in Virginia, we've refined it quite a bit. Dr. Dan Downey from James Madison University has helped us along calculating dosage amounts and actually helped us with the type of limestone sand that we use in these streams now. And it basically works like a time-release capsule, if you will. And over the course of time, as water flows push this along, it doesn't necessarily impact the fisheries component other than improving the environment around which the fish and the macroinvertebrates can operate. So that's one tool of many that we have in fisheries management here in Western Virginia, but liming seems to be a short-term answer to some of these problems while we figure out a long-term answer.
888-WMRA-TALK, our call-in phone number. Johnny in Harrisonburg, thanks for using that number and calling in. Your question or comment, please, for Paul Bugis, Rick Webb, and or Don Kirk.
My question was for mainly you, I suppose, because you posed a dichotomy between jobs and fish or the natural world, and I just wanted to comment that people are part of the natural world, and if we harm it, we are inevitably harming ourselves. The other question was about what problems do they anticipate from climate change? Are they seeing any? If we've got cold water trout, what happens when the cold water isn't there anymore? Thank you. I'll take the answer off
for
air.
Thank you for calling in, Johnny. And Paul, actually, you had mentioned something about temperature affecting these fish.
Right. There's been some interesting studies and some here in our backyard on climate change. Here at JMU in Harrisonburg, Brad Trumbo and Mark Huddy had done some interesting work on climate change by actually going out over the course of a year and a half and measuring air and water temperatures on some of these very trout streams that Rick is talking about, these native trout streams, and using this paired information to determine the vulnerability and the sensitivity of these streams to climate change. And one of the things they did find out that there's so much variation even between the streams that a slight change in our climate doesn't mean an equal amount of degradation or whatever for our brook trout streams. One thing the listeners need to know is that with these brook trout streams, that during the summer, the heat of the summer, these streams operate at close to their maximum level for sustaining brook trout. In other words, they're pushing up in the daytime at 71, 72 degrees. And if you sustain that over a longer period of time, the caller is definitely correct. The habitat or the critical environment for brook trout will shrink over time. And we won't know that except for doing these measurements over time. And right now, the Forest Service and the Game Department are, and UVA, too, in the National Park, are looking at long-term temperature studies to see whether these things creep up over time, and we're using the latest in technology to get this information.
And some of the other influences keeping the streams cool include groundwater or springs, where you have cold water coming from underground, the elevation and the aspect, whether or not your stream is generally south-facing, north-facing. So those are things that help keep the streams cool, in addition to a forested watershed and a forested stream buffer.
Don Kirk, you're a federal employee. You work for the U.S. Forest Service, so I realize that there are some topics that you probably can't get into on the air, and if this is one of them, please feel free to tell me. But Johnny was objecting to the way I phrased my question to the audience to get them talking about how much they see a dichotomy between caring for the environment and caring for the economy. And I'm just curious, when you, as somebody who has spent all of your life caring for the environment, here are elected officials in Washington battling over whether jobs are more important and whether certain industrial projects should be fast-tracked without giving much heed to environmental concerns, and then others saying, wait a minute, you have to protect the environment at all costs. I mean, that's the type of question I was trying to get members of our audience to talk about, but I wonder if any of that kind of conversation ever drives you crazy.
You know, I really focus on my job, which is in the Forest Service, caring for the land and serving people. And, you know, specifically my job is managing aquatic resources on the National Forest in Virginia and part of West Virginia, to the best that we can. And so no matter what's going on in Washington, I stay focused on my job and do what I can for the aquatic resources, for the streams, for the biota, and ultimately to maintain the water chemistry.
This is Rick. I think that sort of a false dichotomy has been posed, and I don't mean to sound critical of Tom, but I don't think that there is a real conflict in between jobs and environmental health. If we take the long view, when the Clean Air Act was amended in 1990 to require reductions in sulfur emissions from power plants, we heard the same arguments, and it seems like we hear them all the time. But the consequences of implementing the Clean Air Act in terms of jobs and cost have simply not been as great as some people were objecting that they would be. So I don't really think that the arguments that are made are often very sound. So I don't think it's a real issue.
This is Paul. And I personally haven't read or are not familiar with, there's been some fantastic technology that has been applied by Dominion and some of the other folks involved with power plants in the Ohio River Valley, West Virginia, whatnot, that where some of the air emissions make their way over into Virginia. And they have applied some great new technology where they've actually scrubbed a lot of the pollutants out of their emissions. And the benefit is what Rick is actually measuring with his students in these trout streams around here. So I don't know that it's necessarily a loss in jobs or anything like that. I just think it's a sound investment in best available technology, and then everybody benefits.
From state government, fisheries biologist Paul Bugis is one of our guests. It was his voice that you were just hearing. From federal government, fisheries biologist Don Kirk is another one of our guests. And filling out our panel, University of Virginia environmental scientist Rick Webb, coordinator of a new report called the Virginia Trout Stream Sensitivity Study. If you have a question or comment for them, our phone lines are open at 1-888-WMRA-TALK. In all numbers, that translates to 888-967-2825. Max in Rockbridge, thanks for calling in. I understand you're associated with a group that Rick Webb mentioned a little earlier called Trout Unlimited?
Yes. Hey, I'm the president of the Skyline chapter of Trout Unlimited, which is participated in the 2010 study by recruiting and training volunteers to collect water samples, and I collected water samples myself and enjoyed doing it. I had a question for the panel today. Was I had a very easy time collecting volunteers to sample water from the brook trout streams that range mainly from Trout Unlimited members, but also included everything from VMI cadets to master naturalists. And I was wondering if some or all of them could comment on the level of collaboration that existed between volunteers from a nonprofit organization like Trout Unlimited that works to protect and conserve these cold water resources, state and federal agencies, and the research university at UVA, and how they work together as a new collaborative model.
Rick Webb.
Hi, Max.
Hey.
There was a tremendous amount of collaboration between the agencies and the volunteer organizations. We had approximately 200 people in the field, which were volunteers. They were organized by about 17 different chapters of Trout Unlimited in Western Virginia. And this is the third time we've done that. We did it in 87 and in 2000 and then again in 2010. So
I take it it's fairly hard work. You're out traipsing in some fairly rough terrain, keeping track of things with great meticulousness.
Well, care has to be taken, but I don't think I would call it hard work.
You got this smile on your face. You think it's fun, don't you?
Well,
and it's probably why you do the kind of work you do.
I'm pretty lucky to be involved in the kind of work that I'm involved in, no question about that. And most of the volunteers who participated in the surveys and some of them who helped with our routine quarterly sampling also seemed to enjoy the work quite a bit. Entire families went out together to collect water samples, and nobody complained about hard work. What amazed me is really the number of people that were involved. And I see it as sort of a testament to the value that people place on wild brook trout streams and their interest in seeing these streams be maintained in good health into the future. And they've come out again and again, and I presume that they will continue to do so. So a lot of people care about the quality of the environment. It means a lot to people. As the world becomes more developed in general and more urban, these wild lands that these brook trout streams represent will become more and more valuable.
One thing just to note is it is remarkable that the program that Rick's talking about, hundreds of people have done this year after year, and they've done it several, this is what, the third time where we've had hundreds of streams sampled. And it's remarkable, the interest and the involvement. And, it does sometimes take some walking quite a ways to get to the sample location. The other thing is that it's really a testament to the organizational skill that UVA has put into it. And also Trout Unlimited has been a huge partner in this effort. So it takes quite an organization to get all the people together, get them to know where they're supposed to be going and sampling, sample correctly, and get the water samples back to the lab in a timely manner.
Max on the phone line with us. The organization that you are a chapter president of, Trout Unlimited, as you mentioned, is a national organization. Before you go, Max, you want to tell us a little bit more about what your organization does and why it exists?
Our organization, which is just over 50 years old, exists to protect and conserve the it's not just cold water streams in the east. It's also out west. It gets into salmon habitat, but it's and just salmonids in general, and really work to do on the ground work in the woods. You know, ranging from collecting water samples to restoring streams, but also then educating the public about these issues, and including a program called Trout in the Classroom, where we actually put fish tanks in K through 12 classrooms, and the school children watch the fish grow from eggs to fingerlings and then release them into the streams and learn more about the ecology of trout. And that's, you know, to me what TU is really about.
And I suspect if anybody wants to find out more about this organization, they can just Google the words Trout Unlimited?
Yes, or go to TU.org.
Max, thanks so much for taking the time to call us and for
Thank
the
you.
Work that you're doing.
Thank you for hosting these folks. I enjoy your program. Thank you, Tom. Bye-bye.
Paul Bugis, you look like you had something you wanted to add there.
I just wanted to add that TU has been a fantastic partner over time. As you can see, universities, government agencies, we all work together to try to apply our knowledge and our management skills in the field to provide a cleaner environment, animals to catch and hunt and whatnot. But the main thing is that we can't do it without partnerships in this day and age. And we have a load of partners that we've dealt with over years. And I just want to thank them. They know who they are out there because unlike Rick, sometimes when we go into the field to sample for fish and so forth, we're bearing 50-pound backpacks and lugging buckets and things that bang against your shins and so forth way up into the mountains. And it's hard work to get there. And so you know who you are out there. We thank you, and we appreciate your effort. The Brook Trout Resource appreciates your effort.
This is Rick. I've been along on a couple of those trips that Paul refers to, helping carry some of that equipment. But there is a remarkable community of people in Virginia who are concerned about protecting this component of our natural world. They're a community of scientists at a number of different universities, volunteer organizations, Trout Unlimited, the Sierra Club, a number of local groups, the people involved with the Master Naturalist Program, plus the federal and state agencies. A lot of people who are very concerned about maintaining the health of our wild brook trout streams in the forested mountain watersheds, which they are part of.
888-WMRA. Talk is our phone number, 888-967-2825. A new report on the apparently improving environmental health of certain cold water streams in Virginia was our beginning point this hour. But now that you've been listening for a while, find you have a question that's not yet been asked, an observation that ought to be added, 888-WMRA. Talk by phone. On Facebook, we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. The coordinator of this new report, Rick Webb from the University of Virginia, is one of our guests. Also with us from the Virginia Department of Inland Game and Fisheries, fisheries biologist Paul Bugis, and from the U.S. Forest Service, fisheries biologist Dawn Kirk. We'll have about 15 minutes to take further questions or comments from them when we get back in just a few moments. To you listening, is there a story about how clean air and clean water became especially important to you? Maybe a time when a favorite relative took you fishing when you were a child, some lesson you were exposed to in high school or college. On the other hand, did there come a time when you began to feel that environmentalism had gone too far and that not enough was being done to protect certain industries from what you considered to be overly enthusiastic environmentalists? 888-WMRA. Talk is our phone number, 888-967-2825. Justin in Stanton, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
Well, hi. First of all, this is Justin in Stanton. I just wanted to thank all of our guests. As an avid fly fisherman, I
appreciate what they do in saving the brook trout here in Virginia. I wanted to just make everyone know that, you know, these are some of the most beautiful, pristine parts of the wilderness. And, you know, just as a homeowner, landowner on a river, what's the best thing that someone could do to help make sure they keep the waterways clean?
This is Paul. I think as a landowner, take a look at your entire property, and then one step beyond, go beyond your property boundaries and look at the watershed itself from your point in the watershed, your aspect in the watershed upstream. Some folks live in the heart of the valley and may not have brook trout water or the opportunity to, quote, turn their water into brook trout water. But if you live in an area that's been denuded along the riparian or streamside zone of trees and shrubs and grasses and so forth, one of the first things you can do is just try to get that back and restored and get some shade on the stream, because trees and clean water go hand in glove.
Justin, thanks so much for your call. Rick Webb, if I'm tracking correctly, your study has looked primarily at the impact of sulfur emissions and the resultant acid rain on this environment that we're talking about, cold water streams. And one of the reasons we talk about brook trout in them is because they're so sensitive to changes. Are there other stressors in this part of our environment that we should also be talking about?
Well, the main stressor that people are currently concerned about is climate change, and that translates to increasing temperature in brook trout streams. Some of the studies that have been done suggest that in perhaps as few as 50 years, we may lose most of the brook trout streams in the Virginia mountains if climate change and increasing temperature does materialize. Now, we've been studying these streams in Shenandoah National Park and in the National Forest for 20 to 30 years, and we've been seeing an increase in stream water temperature, which is consistent with the global warming concept. In the long term, 30 years is not a long period of time. We've seen perhaps an increase in 1 degree Fahrenheit per year, per decade, which when you consider that summertime temperatures in brook trout streams are in many cases marginal, just a few degrees change in temperature does make a huge difference. So it's probably premature to say that this temperature change we're seeing in these streams in Shenandoah National Park in particular are associated with overall global climate change. It is something to be concerned about.
This is Paul, and again, Forest Service, Park Service, Game and Inland Fisheries all are picking up on this, and we are putting these remote temperature loggers out there to look at temperature change in the long run. I think Rick's 25-year data set can speak to changes in temperature, and he is certainly correct in that brook trout streams can't afford to take too much of a temperature bump, especially during the summer months where things are really critical, or these fish tend to leave or die in the system or whatever, and other fish will move up and take their place. This remains to be seen. There's been a lot of modeling going on out there as far as what's going to happen with these brook trout streams over time, but I think one of the best things we can do is get out there and measure it and get another good long-term data set in place.
Chuck in Buckingham, thanks for calling in on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment, please, for Rick Webb, Paul Bugis, and or Don Kirk.
Yes, I do. I've watched over the years as all the land around me has been timbered, and timbered up to one tree from all the streams that run through their land and mine. When I talked to the local Virginia forestry representative, he says, well, the timber companies around are using best practices. And I'm just wondering, is that the case?
This is Paul speaking again. I'm not sure about down in your county. There are best management practices set forth that are voluntary things that foresters can apply to the land as they timber it. And if applied correctly, you can log and maintain clean water. There's been a logging in the national forest for some time, And I've personally witnessed over the course of my career that if these BMPs, as we call them, are applied to the land, the careful crossings, careful approaches to these streams, the shading stays on the streams, and so on and so forth, you can maintain a high level of water quality and get your wood out.
And this is Dawn. The BMPs are best management practices that are voluntary in Virginia. They set aside a streamside management zone and set out a distance for keeping vehicles away or putting in roads. Or they're not necessarily a no harvest zone, but they will look at things like Paul said, maintaining shade on the stream, a certain amount of wood in the system, and a certain distance. And part of it is to help keep sediment from running down roads or moving across the land surface and getting into the stream, because the stream systems are often very sensitive to changes in habitat, such as sedimentation.
Chuck, it sounds like you feel that there's some doubt in your mind about whether best management is, in fact, going on here.
Yes. I mean, I certainly can understand the erosion control side of it and how that may be taken into account here. But from the temperature perspective, you know, I would question whether the buffers I see being left actually do anything good for the streams.
The point that I was going to make, this is Rick, is that if the streams have been damaged, it's quite likely that best management practices have not, in fact, been applied. If the trees have been removed right up to the stream side, best management practices have not been applied. So
if someone like Chuck is concerned and he's going to an agency that's saying, look, best management practices have been used here, he disagrees. Does he have a next step? Is there somebody else that he can appeal to? A state legislator or a member of Congress or some advocacy group?
Well, this is Paul. Most of the work obviously needs to be done up front before the sale even takes place. And usually, in most cases, the state forester for that county or counties is involved. And these folks are well-versed in the kind of BMPs that need to be applied depending on the lay of the land, how steep the land is, what water courses are running through the land, and so on and so forth.
But what we've got here is somebody who feels like he's been told one thing and he disagrees. And it is not the first time, perhaps, that somebody encountering some sort of government agency is saying, I don't think you're seeing this clearly. So in a case like that, rather than just accept the response that he gets from the agency he's talking to, is there somebody else he can go to and get a second opinion? Or is there some sort of advocacy group that he can talk to and see what their opinion is? And I guess we don't have an answer here.
Well, all I can say is that, and this is Rick, is that I share the caller's frustration.
So we did have one group that was mentioned earlier in the show, Chuck, that obviously has some environmental concerns. We don't know what their perspective on this is, but it's called Trout Unlimited. And if you wanted to Google that group, or I guess it was TU.org is their website, see if they've got an opinion for you. But we sure do appreciate you sharing your perspective with us here today.
Well, thank you for the time.
Don Kirk is a fisheries biologist with the U.S. Forest Service. Paul Bugis is a fisheries biologist from the State Department of Inland Game and Fisheries. Rick Webb is a senior scientist and project coordinator in the University of Virginia's Department of Environmental Sciences. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham. This is Virginia Insight, and we've only got a couple more minutes to take calls. If you have an environmental concern you want to share or a question for our guests, all of our phone lines are now open at 888-WMRA-TALK, 1-888-967-2825. Rick Webb, another one of our Facebook posts over the weekend, talking about today's show coming up, started with the question, should you care about researcher Rick Webb's new study? And then it went on to describe a little bit about what we've talked about. And Ron posted in response to that question, it would be terrible not to care. We are plenty able to degrade our living space as it is. I suspect that that may be an opinion you appreciate.
Of course. One thing we need to be aware of here, we're talking about the fact that there has been improvement, but there is more that needs to be done. As I mentioned earlier, there has been a great reduction in the amount of sulfur which is being emitted in the atmosphere, about two-thirds from the level that was emitted in 1990. But still, it's several times greater than the background pre-industrial level. And even if we reduce that back to background level, some of these streams that we have in Western Virginia have been damaged to the point where they're not going to recover in our lifetimes. Thus, we have the need for programs like the streamlining program that the Forest Service and the Department of Game and Inland Fisheries are involved in. At the same time, what they are doing is simply maintaining the aquatic life. They're not actually addressing the problem, which is the acidification of the forest and soils in the watersheds. But it's the best that can be done. And a fraction of these streams have been damaged. It's been a cumulative damage. It occurred over time, and we're not going to see recovery. And the number of streams, the percentage of streams that are in this category will increase over time until we are able to reduce sulfur deposition, sulfur emissions, which cause that deposition and the associated acid rain, until we get that back to close to background level. And I do believe that we have the technology to do that, and we can do so without a great economic impact. We just have to be willing to do it.
Next to Palmyra, Jackie, thank you for calling in. Your question or comment for our guests, please.
Yes, my question or comment. I live in Palmyra, and I love fishing on the James River, and I have noticed within the last 10 years a major decline in bass and even the bluegill population, and I was wondering why Game and Inland Fisheries, why don't we stock bass?
Well, this is Paul. Funny you should ask. We've got a pilot project where we have supplementally stocked smallmouth bass when we have year class failures. The problem with that is that we don't have the hatchery wherewithal to maintain levels of bass in rivers. Through our studies, we found over time that it's really the flows that occur in June in midsummer, whether it affects year class strength or how strong that cohort of bass is coming off. If that cohort is damaged, and don't forget, most of these fish just spawn one time a year, you've got time gaps between strong year classes and weak year classes, and sometimes we see that in our big rivers. But I don't think stocking is always the answer to our issues out there. Granted, the Game and Inland Fisheries does have a very active stocking program, both in cold water and warm water, but I truly believe in a lot of circumstances it's best to step back and look at the causes, the big causes of these issues, and try to correct them if time and money allows. So I appreciate that comment.
Jackie, thank you so much for your call, and I want to apologize to you, Paul. Apparently I have at least a couple of times, if not more, miscombobulated the name of your agency. It is the Department of Game and Inland Fisheries as opposed to the Department of Inland Game and Fisheries. So I'll try and get it right at least one more time. But before we go, Dawn Kirk, in the work that you do and looking at the health of streams in the Jefferson and Washington National Forests, is it true that insects are also an indicator of things to be concerned or not concerned about?
Yes, we have a extensive macroinvertebrate or aquatic insect monitoring program. And that's one of the components that Paul had talked about earlier in the show. We looked at not just the fish, but the stream insects. And that's a major part of our monitoring program on the National Forest. And why monitor insects? Well, often in some of the small streams that don't even have fish, we'll have a complete insect community. And so when you look at the insects, you can look at the community and tell whether or not you have tolerant insects or acid-sensitive insects, and whether or not some of those components have dropped out of the overall community. And you can infer the stream health.
And in less than the minute that we have left, is there anything in particular that you're seeing in terms of indicators right now?
Well, this is Paul speaking. What we're seeing with the insects is that shortly after these liming episodes that I mentioned earlier, too, we see quick rebounds of these insects in response to a more a gentle environment, if you will, for them to reproduce and spread out through these watersheds. So it does have a good bump effect on the food web, and it helps out our brook trout populations in the long haul.
Our guests have been U.S. Forest Service fisheries biologist Dawn Kirk from the state of Virginia's Department of Game and Inland Fisheries, fisheries biologist Paul Bugis, plus senior scientist from the Department of Environmental Sciences at the University of Virginia, Rick Webb. Thank you all so much for making time for us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Insight Archives. And if you go to that page, you'll find a link to Mr. Webb's new study of trout stream sensitivity in Virginia with full-color pictures and graphs, I might add. Of course, if you like Virginia Insight on Facebook, you'll have access to a whole bunch more information about these broadcasts from that avenue as well. Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers are Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jospe and Inner Rhythm. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.